to help fulfill your goals. Everyone from your family to your mailman is a portal to an entirely new set of folks. So don't wait until you're out of a job or on your own to begin reaching out to others. You've got to create a community of colleagues and friends before you need it. Others around you are far more likely to help you if they already know and like you. Start gardening now. You won't believe the treasures to be found within your own backyard. Chapter 5. The Genius of Audacity. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe wrote, "Seize this very minute. What you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power and magic in it." My father, Pete Ferrazzi, was a first-generation American, a merchant marine sailor in World War II, and an uneducated steelworker whose world was hard hours and low wages. He wanted more for me, his son. He and I were inseparable when I was growing up. His friends called me Repeat because he took me everywhere with him. He knew I would have a better life if he could help me find a way out of our working-class heritage. But my dad didn't know the exits. He'd never been to college. He knew nothing of country clubs or private schools. He could picture only one man who would have the sort of pull that could help me. His boss. Actually, the boss of his boss's boss, Alex McKenna, CEO of Kennametal, in whose factory my dad worked. The two men had never met. But Dad had a clear sense of how the world worked. He'd observed, even from the plant floor, that audacity was often the only thing that separated two equally talented men and their job titles. So he asked to speak with McKenna. McKenna, upon hearing the request, was so intrigued that he took the meeting. In the course of the meeting, he agreed to meet me, but nothing more. It turned out that McKenna liked me, partly because of the way I had come to his attention. He served on the board of a local private elementary school, the Valley School of Ligonier, where all the wealthy families sent their children. By reputation, it was one of the best elementary schools in the country. Strings were pulled, and Mr. McKenna got us an appointment with Peter Messer, the headmaster. The day I enrolled in the Valley School, on scholarship, I entered a new world that set me on an entirely new course, just as my father had hoped. I got one of the best educations in America, starting with Valley School, then Kiske School, Yale University, and on to Harvard Business School. And it would never have happened if my father hadn't believed that it never hurts to ask. As I look back on my career, that education was the single most important act in my life. Moreover, the lesson I learned from my father's action, like no other, informed all that I have done since. My father simply couldn't be embarrassed when it came to fulfilling his family's needs. I remember once we were driving down the road to our home when Dad spotted a broken big-wheel tricycle in someone's trash. He stopped the car, picked it up, and knocked on the door of the home where the discarded toy lay waiting to be picked up. "I spotted this big-wheel in your trash," he told the owner. "Do you mind if I take it? I think I can fix it. It would make me feel wonderful to give my son something like this." What guts! Can you imagine such a proud working-class guy approaching that woman and essentially admitting he's so poor that he'd like to have her garbage? Oh, but that's not the half of it. Imagine how that woman felt, having been given the opportunity to give such a gift to another person. It surely made her day. "Of course," she gushed, explaining that her children were grown and that years had passed since the toy had been used. "You're welcome to the bicycle I have, too. It's nice enough that I just couldn't throw it away." So we drove on. I had a new big wheel to ride and a bike to grow into. She had a smile and a fluttering heart that only benevolence breeds. And Dad had taught me that there is genius, even kindness, in being bold. Every time I start to set limits to what I can and can't do, or fear starts to creep into my thinking, I remember that big-wheeled tricycle. I remind myself how people with a low tolerance for risk, whose behavior is guided by fear, have a low propensity for success. The memories of those days have stuck with me. My father taught me that the worst anyone can say is no. If they choose not to give their time or their help, it's their loss. Nothing in my life has created opportunity like a willingness to ask, whatever the situation. When I was just an anonymous attendee at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, I walked onto a hotel bus and saw Nike founder Phil Knight. Knight was like a rock star to me, given his extraordinary success at creating and building Nike, and the many marketing innovations he introduced over the years. Was I nervous? You bet. But I jumped at the opportunity to speak with him, and made a beeline for the seat next to his. Later, he would become Yaya's first blue-chip customer. I do this sort of thing all the time, whatever the situation. Sometimes I fail. I've got an equally long list of people I've attempted to befriend who weren't interested in my overtures. Audacity in networking has the same pitfalls and fears associated with dating, which I was never as good at as I am the business variety of meeting people. Sticking to the people we already know is tempting behavior. But unlike some forms of dating, a networker isn't looking to achieve only a single successful union. Creating an enriching circle of trusted relationships requires one to be out there, in the mix, all the time. To this day, every time I make a call or introduce myself to people I don't know, the fear that they might reject me is there. Then I remember the big wheel my father gave me, and push ahead anyway. Most of us don't find networking the least bit instinctive or natural. Of course, there are individuals whose inherent self-confidence and social skills enable them to connect with ease. Then there are the rest of us. In the early days at Yaya, I was worried for the company's survival. For the first time in my career, I had to reach out to a lot of people I didn't know, representing an unknown company, pushing a product that was untested in the marketplace. It was uncomfortable. I didn't want to cold call executives from BMW and MasterCard and pitch them my wares. But you know what? Pushing to get into BMW was not that difficult when the alternative was laying off a bunch of my staff or failing in the eyes of my board and investors. Mustering the audacity to talk with people who didn't know me often simply comes down to balancing the fear I have of embarrassment against the fear of failure and its repercussions. For my father, either he asked or his family didn't have. For me, I either ask or I'm not successful. That fear always overrides my anxiety about rejection or being embarrassed. Ultimately, everyone has to ask himself or herself how they're going to fail. We all do, you know. So let's get that out of the way. The choice isn't between success and failure. It's between choosing risk and striving for greatness, or risking nothing and being certain of mediocrity. For many people, the fear of meeting others is closely tied to the fear of public speaking, a fear that consistently beats out death as the one thing we dread most. Some of the world's most famous speakers admit to feeling similar anxiety. As Mark Twain said, "There are two types of speakers, those that are nervous and those that are liars." The best way to deal with this anxiety is to first acknowledge that our fear is perfectly normal. You are not alone. The second thing is to recognize that getting over that fear is critical to your success. The third is to commit to getting better. Here are a few things you can do today to make good on that commitment and get more comfortable at being audacious in social situations. Find a role model. We're predisposed to seek out people like us. Shy people tend to congregate with other shy people, and outgoing people congregate with outgoing people, because they unconsciously affirm our own behaviors. But everyone knows that one person within their group of friends and associates who seems to engage others with little or no fear. If you're not yet ready to take the big leap of addressing new people on your own, let these people help you and show you the way. Take them with you, when appropriate, to social outings and observe their behaviors. Pay attention to their actions. Over time, you'll adopt some of their techniques. Slowly, you'll build up the courage to reach out by yourself. Learn to speak. Many businesses have responded to the nearly infinite number of people who recognize they need to become better speakers. These educational organizations realize you're not looking to give speeches to an audience of 1,000 people, at least initially. Most people who come to them for help are looking to gain self-confidence and some trusty tools for overcoming shyness. They don't offer one or two simple quick-fix cure-alls. What they do is a chance to practice in a non-intimidating environment with an instructor who can guide and push you. There are hundreds of coaches and schools devoted to this type of training. One of the most well-known is the Toastmasters Club. They're sure to have a local chapter in your area. It is a well-run organization that has helped millions of people hone their speaking skills and overcome their fears. Get involved. You'll feel most comfortable when you're doing something you enjoy with others who share your enthusiasm. Any hobby is an opportunity to get involved. Stamp collecting, singing, sports, literature. Clubs develop around all of these interests. Join up. Become an active member. When you feel up to it, become one of the leaders of the group. This last step is crucial. Being a leader in life takes practice. So practice. The possibilities for making new contacts and reaching out to others will grow and grow. Get therapy. I know, you're probably thinking, he wants me to go to therapy to become better at talking to people. Let me explain. 1. I think merely acting on the desire to be better than you are now, no matter the venue, is a very important commitment. 2. Some of the most successful people I know have been to a therapist at one point or another in their lives. I'm not suggesting therapy will make you a better people person, but it might help you address your own fears and social anxieties in a more productive way. Many studies funded by the National Institute of Mental Health report a high success rate using counseling to alleviate the conditions that normally inhibit a shy person. Just do it. Set a goal for yourself of initiating a meeting with one new person a week. It doesn't matter where or with whom. Introduce yourself to someone on the bus. Slide up next to someone at the bar and say hello. Hang out at the company water cooler and force yourself to talk to a fellow employee you've never spoken with. You'll find that it gets easier and easier with practice. Best of all, you'll get comfortable with the idea of rejection. With that perspective, even failure becomes a step forward. Embrace it as learning. As the playwright Samuel Beckett wrote, "Fail, fail again. Fail better." Fear debilitates. Once you realize there's no benefit to holding back, every situation and every person, no matter how seemingly beyond your reach, becomes an opportunity to succeed. The Madam of Moxie. When it comes to improving your speaking skills, no one is better than Deanne Rosenberg. A 32-year career counselor and owner of her own management consulting firm, Deanne Rosenberg, Inc. Rosenberg is the Madam of Moxie, and for good reason. In 1969, she read a Wall Street Journal article that noted the absence of a female voice in the American Management Association. They were interviewing the then president of the AMA, who was quoted as saying, "We haven't found a woman who can speak authoritatively in public about management," Rosenberg recalls. She cut the article out and sent a letter to the AMA, telling them to look no further. 2 weeks went by, and her letter went unanswered. "Well, that wouldn't do," she snaps. "I wrote another letter straight to the president, effectively telling them to put up or shut up." 2 days later, the president of the association called to say that they had scheduled her for a lecture. Deanne went on to become the first woman to speak on behalf of the AMA. The lesson from that fateful series of events remains with her. The recipe for achievement is a medley of self-assuredness, dogged persistence, and audacity. Encounters of the audacious kind, as Rosenberg learned, are what successful careers are built upon. In her many years teaching others to overcome their fears, she's created a time-tested script that anyone can use when meeting someone for the first time. I found the script helpful. I think it can help a lot of you as well, and I gratefully offer it to you here. 1. State the situation. You go right in and hit them with how you see it in the cold light of day, without being too inflammatory or dramatic, says Rosenberg. She made it clear to the AMA that A, having no women speakers was wrong, and B, hiring her would be a step in the right direction. It makes sense that before you can speak persuasively, that is, before you speak from a position of passion and personal knowledge, you need to know where you stand. 2. Communicate your feelings. We downplay the influence of emotions in our day-to-day contacts, especially in the business world. We're told that vulnerability is a bad thing, and we should be wary of revealing our feelings. But as we gain comfort using "I feel" with others, our encounters take on depth and sincerity. Your emotions are a gift of respect and caring to your listeners. 3. Deliver the bottom line. This is the moment of truth when you state with utter clarity what it is you want. If you're going to put your neck on the line, you'd better know why. The truth is the fastest route to a solution. But be realistic. While I knew Phil Knight of Nike wasn't going to buy anything based on 1 5-minute conversation on a bus in Davos, Switzerland, I did make sure to get his email and tell him that I'd like to follow up with him again sometime. Then I did so. 4. Use an open-ended question. A request that is expressed as a question, one that cannot be answered by a yes or no, is less threatening. How do you feel about this? How can we solve this problem? The issue has been raised, your feelings expressed, your desires articulated. With an open-ended suggestion or question, you invite the other person to work toward a solution with you. I didn't insist on a specific lunch date at a specific time with Phil. I left it open and didn't allow our first exchange to be weighted down by unnecessary obligations. Chapter 6. The Networking Jerk. Edmund Burke said, "Ambition can creep as well as soar." He is the man, or she is the woman, with a martini in one hand, business cards in the other, and a pre-rehearsed elevator pitch always at the ready. He or she is a schmooze artist, eyes darting at every event in a constant search for a bigger fish to fry. He or she is the insincere, ruthlessly ambitious glad-hander you don't want to become. The networking jerk is the image that many people have when they hear the word networking. But in my book, this breed of hyper-contact builder and card counter fails to grasp the nuances of authentic connecting. Their shtick doesn't work because they don't know the first thing about creating meaningful relationships. As I learned the hard way. If you knew me as a younger man, you may not have liked me. I'm not sure I like myself that much. I made all the classic mistakes of youth and insecurity. I was pretty much out for myself. I wore my unquenchable ambition on my sleeve, befriending those above me and ignoring my peers. Too often, people put on one face with their subordinates, another with their boss, and another one yet with their friends. When I became responsible for marketing at Deloitte, I suddenly had a lot of people reporting to me. I had some very big ideas about what I wanted to do, things that never had been done from a marketing standpoint in the world of consulting. And now, finally, I had a team with which to execute them. But instead of viewing my employees as partners to be wooed in achieving my long-term objectives and theirs, I saw them as called upon to carry out my tasks. Add to this my young age. I was 20 years younger than any other member of the executive committee, and you can understand why the resistance among my staff was holding all of us back. Tasks that I thought should have taken hours ended up taking days. I knew I needed to do something, so I reached out to an executive coach, Nancy Bedore, who had been coaching high-level CEOs before there was a name for such thing. The day of our first meeting, sitting in my office, we barely had a chance to exchange pleasantries before I blurted out, "What do I need to do to become a great leader?" She looked around my office for a few moments and said nothing. When she finally spoke, it struck me to the core. "Keith, look at all the pictures on your wall. You talk about aspiring to become a great leader, and there's not one picture in your whole office of anybody but you. You with other famous people, you in famous places, you winning awards. There's not one picture in here of your team or of anything that might indicate what your team has accomplished that would lead anybody like me to know that you care for them as much as you care for yourself. Do you understand that it's your team's accomplishments and what they do because of you, not for you, that will generate your mark as a leader?" I was floored by her question. She was absolutely right. Had I shown the genuine concern I had for the lives my employees led outside of work? Why hadn't I made an effort to make them part of the leadership? I'd been doing it with my bosses from day one. I realized then my long-term success depended on everyone around me, that I worked for them as much as they worked for me. Politicians understand this in a way too few executives grasp. We vote for the people we like and respect. Great companies are built by CEOs who inspire love and admiration. In today's world, mean guys finish last. My friend and author Tim Sanders taught me there are two reasons for the end of the era of mean business. First, we live in a new abundance of choice in business, in everything from products to career paths. Choice spells doom for difficult colleagues and leaders. At a time when more of us have more options than ever, there's no need to put up with a product or service that doesn't deliver, a company that we don't like, or a boss whom we don't respect, he writes. The second reason is what he calls the new telegraph. It's almost impossible for a shoddy product, a noxious company, or a crummy person to keep its, his, or her sad reality a secret anymore. People are highly opinionated, well-informed, and armed with the Internet. The bottom line is, if you don't like someone, it's easier than ever to escape him. When you don't have others' interests at heart, people will find out sooner rather than later. Our culture demands more of us these days. It demands that we treat each other with respect, that every relationship be seen in mutually beneficial terms. When you look back upon a life and career of reaching out to others, you want to see a web of friendships to fall back on, not the ashes of bad encounters. Here are a few rules I can suggest from personal experience to ensure you never become a networking jerk. 1. Don't schmooze. Have something to say and say it with passion. Make sure you have something to offer when you speak, and offer it with sincerity. Most people haven't figured out that it's better to spend more time with fewer people at a one-hour get-together and have one or two meaningful dialogues, then engage in the wandering eye routine and lose the respect of most of the people you meet. I get emails all the time that read, "Dear Keith, I hear you're a good networker. I am too. Let's sit down for 15 minutes and a cup of coffee." Why? I ask myself, why in the world do people expect me to respond to a request like that? Have they appealed to me emotionally? Have they said they could help me? Have they sought some snippet of commonality between us? I'm sorry, but networking is not a secret society with some encoded handshake practiced for its own virtue. We must bring virtue to it. Two. Don't rely on the currency of gossip. Of course, using gossip is easier. Most people lap up such information, but it won't do you any good in the long run. Eventually, the information well will run dry as more and more people realize you're not to be trusted. 3. Don't come to the party empty-handed. Who are the stars of today's digital world? Those writers, bloggers, and gurus who do the best job of providing information, creative content, links, or even just empathy to a community of like-minded individuals. Many of them do it all for free, and their reward is a devout following of people who in return offer as much as they receive. It's a loop. In connecting, online and off, you're only as good as what you give away. 4. Don't treat those under you poorly. Soon enough, some of them will become overlings. In business, the food chain is transient. You must treat people with respect up and down the ladder. Michael Ovitz, once one of the most powerful of Hollywood's super agents, was said to be a master networker. By 2002, a scathing Vanity Fair profile with dozens of anonymous and not-so-anonymous sources taking shots at the man was a very public expression of a dazzling career that had somehow gone horribly wrong. People asked, what happened? Ovitz has some amazing interpersonal skills, but he wielded them disingenuously. People he no longer needed, he treated with indifference, or worse. Former friends said that he wasn't trustworthy and that his relationships weren't reciprocal. It wasn't surprising that these same people not only reveled in, but may have also contributed to his fall. 5. Be transparent. I am what I am, the cartoon character Popeye used to say. In the information age, openness, whether it concerns your intentions, the information you provide, or even your admiration, has become a valuable and much sought-after attribute. People respond with trust when they know you're dealing straight with them. At a conference, when I run into someone I've been dying to meet, I don't hide my enthusiasm. It's a pleasure to finally meet you. I've admired your work from afar for quite some time and been thinking how beneficial it might be if we could meet one another. Coy games may work in a bar, but not when you're looking to establish a deeper, more meaningful connection. 6. Don't be too efficient. Nothing comes off as less sincere than receiving a mass email addressed to a long list of recipients. Reaching out to others is not a numbers game. Your goal is to make genuine connections with people you can count on. I'm embarrassed by the way I learned this lesson. I had always heard that sending out holiday New Year's greeting cards was a good idea. So I began a practice when I graduated Yale to send a holiday card to everyone in my contact database. By the time I was at Deloitte, the list was thousands of people long, and I was hiring temp help to address and even sign the cards at year's end. Well, we can all see this coming. The intention was good enough until a college roommate noted, actually jibed, how appreciative he was to get not one, but actually three cards one year, all with different signatures. It's not about mass. It's about a real connection. If you're not making friends while connecting, best to resign yourself to dealing with people who don't care much about what happens to you. Being disliked will kill your connecting efforts before they begin. Alternatively, being liked can be the most potent, constructive force for getting business done. Connector's Hall of Fame Profile. Catherine Graham, 1917-2001. Cultivate trust in everyone. Tragedy transformed Catherine Graham from wife to publisher overnight. She took over the Washington Post in 1963 after the death of her husband, Philip Graham. Her shy and quiet demeanor seemed unfit to deal with the demands of one of the most important newspapers in the country. Graham proved everyone wrong. She helped to build one of the great newspapers and most successful businesses in America. During her era, the Post published the Pentagon Papers, took President Nixon head-on over Watergate, and ruled Washington's political and media scene in a style that was inimitably her own. In fact, it was this style that is her most lasting legacy. Running the Post with compassion, kindness, and sincerity, Graham became a powerful figure. Graham's influence gave her an ability to empower others, from the highest echelons of society to its lowest, with a sense of dignity and respect. Richard Cohen, a columnist for the Washington Post, wrote the following a few days after Graham's funeral. On a beastly July Sunday some years ago, I returned to Washington from the beach and took a taxi to the parking garage across the street from the Washington Post where I kept my car. A tent had been erected on the Post's own parking lot. It was for a company party, given for people whose names you never hear, those unbylined, non-TV appearing types, who take the ads, or deliver the paper, or maybe just clean the building. In the heat, I saw Catherine Graham plodding toward the party. She was old by then, and walking was difficult for her. She pushed her way up the ramp, moving in a laborious fashion. She had a farm in Virginia, a house in Georgetown, an apartment in New York, and most significantly, that hideously hot day, a place on the water in Martha's Vineyard. Yet here she was. Incredibly, I thought, doing the sort of thing vice presidents for smiling do in other companies. Analyze the life of Catherine Graham, and one inescapable theme emerges. Despite a lifetime free from financial worry and a social status bordering on royalty, she made friends with everyone, not just those who could assist her newspaper or augment her position within the Beltway. Most reports on her funeral mentioned celebrity names like Henry Kissinger, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Tom Brokaw. But you don't have to do much heavy lifting before you find an extensive list of non-celebrity attendees. Here's a sampling. Irvin Kologdon, a Fairfax County special education teacher who founded a student breakdancing team with a $350 Washington Post grant. Rosalind Stiles, from the Frederick Douglass Early Childhood and Family Support Center, for which Graham had helped raise money. Henrietta Barbier, of Bethesda, a woman retired from the Foreign Service, belonged to a weekly bridge club of about 60 women at the Chevy Chase Women's Club. She said Graham never missed a session. She was bright about the game, and she took lessons, and she was serious. All of which reveals an inner truth about the skill of reaching out to others. Those who are best at it don't network. They make friends. They gain admirers and win trust precisely because their amicable overtures extend to everyone. A widening circle of influence is an unintended result, not a calculated aim. Graham's relationship with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, more than anyone, highlighted her flair for friendship qua friendship, as opposed to friendship for ulterior purposes. On the surface, the two seemed the unlikeliest of pals. After all, the crucial moments of Graham's career were stunning blows to Kissinger's. First, in 1971, there was Graham's decision to publish the Pentagon Papers, confidential documents detailing the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. A year later, the Post, at Graham's behest, began its Watergate investigations. Both led to the embarrassment of the Nixon administration in which Kissinger served. Yet there was Kissinger, the first speaker to eulogize Graham at her funeral. He and Graham frequently attended movies together. How did Graham form such an alliance, such a friendship? How did she create connections with everyone from anonymous teachers to the world's most famous and powerful? By knowing her boundaries and cultivating trust in others, by being discreet, by the sincerity of her intentions, by letting the other person know she had his or her best interests at heart. In an interview with CNN, Kissinger remarked, "It was a strange relationship in the sense that her paper was on the opposite side from my views very often, but she never attempted to use our friendship for any benefit for her newspaper. She never asked me for special interviews or anything of that kind." Section 2. The Skill Set. Chapter 7. Do Your Homework. Robert H. Schuller wrote, "Spectacular achievement is always preceded by spectacular preparation." Whom you meet, how you meet them, and what they think of you afterward should not be left to chance. As Winston Churchill would tell us, preparation is, if not the key to genius, then at least the key to sounding like a genius. Before I meet with any new people I've been thinking of introducing myself to, I research who they are and what their business is. I find out what's important to them, their hobbies, challenges, goals, inside their business and out. Before the meeting, I generally prepare, or have my assistant prepare, a one-page synopsis on the person I'm about to meet. The only criterion for what should be included is that I want to know what this person is like as a human being, what he or she feels strongly about, and what his or her proudest achievements are. Sure, you should also be up to date on what's happening within the company of a person you want to establish a relationship with. Did the person have a good or bad quarter? Do they have a new product? Trust me, all people naturally care, generally above and beyond anything else, about what it is they do. If you're informed enough to step comfortably into their world and talk knowledgeably, their appreciation will be tangible. As William James wrote, "The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated." These days, doing such research is easy, and yet you'd be surprised how few people make the time to do it. Here are a few guidelines, not so much of where to look, but of how to look at it. Google. Going to a meeting without Googling someone is unacceptable. Besides leading you to relevant info, a quick search gives you something more subtle, a sense of how active the person is online and how much information they share. LinkedIn. Take a look to see how you're connected and what groups they've joined. Read their work history and summary info carefully. The summary will often reveal what they're most proud of professionally and perhaps what goals they're working toward. Also, check out their last activity on the site. Twitter. See if they have an account and how they're using it. Also look for a company account and use search.twitter.com to see if there's any ongoing conversation. Literature from the company's public relations department. Generally, most of what they have will be available on their company site, which you should visit first. But it doesn't hurt to call and explain that you have a scheduled meeting and would like some background information. Annual reports. They'll give you a good idea of where a company is headed and what challenges and opportunities lie ahead. Notice I left Facebook off the list, despite the fact that it's potentially a treasure trove of highly personal information. Of course, tick it off your list as you prep, but keep in mind that our carefully curated Facebook personae often neglect our most passionate or pressing issues. Ironically, though our sharing has become incredibly granular, I am chagrined to admit I once shared a picture of myself shirtless brushing my teeth at an airport. Our willingness to open up publicly about stuff that's challenging us, stuff that really matters, hasn't really changed much at all. Setting out to know someone inevitably means understanding what their problems or needs are. Here, there's still no substitute for asking questions and listening carefully. At work, the challenge may be their product line. But as you talk with the person, you'll also find out that perhaps their kids are hoping to land an internship, that they themselves have health issues, or they just want to cut strokes off their golf game. The point is, once you've done everything you can to prepare, you still have to reach beyond the odd collection of data points that add up to our public identity and get to someone as an individual. Find a way to become part of those things that are of most interest to them, and you will have found a way to become part of their life. I once took part in a roundtable discussion sponsored by the Milken Institute's Global Conference in Los Angeles, an annual three-day gathering that brings together the world's top thinkers and CEOs to work over global problems. There were 15 participants, each one an executive of a company far bigger than my own. In many settings, I probably wouldn't have been rubbing elbows with them, but because I had helped organize the conference, always an advantage, I was invited to participate. The events were planned with the CEO's tight schedule in mind. There was a brief mixer before the event to allow the participants to mingle and get to know one another. Then a panel discussion on the future of marketing, given the challenges facing big brands. Afterward, a short dinner. In other words, there was about a 3-hour window of opportunity where I could hope to establish a foundation for one or two relationships. A successful conference's agenda is always created to maximize the participants' time. My own goal at such conferences is to maximize the brief windows of opportunity I might get to become intimate with other interesting people I haven't met before. Food, I find, has a unique ability to facilitate conversation. People are usually open, even eager, to be amused while eating. Meals at conventions, however, are problematic. They're rushed, frenetic affairs that call for gracious but unobtrusive small talk. You're never sure where you'll end up sitting. And among strangers, it's usually difficult to focus beyond the people sitting either to your left or right. And during the panel, people are focused on their own presentations. That left the mixer. During mixers, I like to hang out near the bar. Virtually everyone gets a drink at some point. Throughout the day, I had also scouted out which rooms the people I wanted to meet were holding court in for the day and arranged my schedule so that I could be there as they were walking in or out. It sounds a bit manipulative, but really, it's just putting yourself in the right position at the right time. The challenge in such circumstances, as it is in every conversation, is to try to transcend the trivialities of polite chit-chat. I had gotten to know the lead organizer of the event during the preceding months, and based on casual conversation, I generally knew who was coming. Not privileged information, but useful in my preparation. My office compiled simple bios of the VIPs who were coming in case I ended up meeting them or sitting next to them. My assistant prepared a few one-pagers on the one or two individuals I especially wanted to meet. This is all part of what I call just doing your homework. That alone, however, is not enough. The idea is to find a point of common ground that is deeper and richer than what can be discovered in a serendipitous encounter. Armed with knowledge about a person's passions, needs, or interests, you can do more than connect. You'll have an opportunity to bond and impress. A master politician like Winston Churchill planned his public encounters in the same way. Churchill today is known as an oratory genius, master of the art of repartee, the kind of fantastic dinner guest who captures everyone's undivided attention. What is less known, but which Churchill acknowledged in his own writing, is the blood, sweat, and tears of preparation that went into the making of a single sentence or the delivery of a clever joke. Churchill realized the power of knowing his audience and knowing how to push their buttons. So how did I do? I discovered that one of the CEOs, John Pepper, was also a fellow graduate of Yale. I had admired him since I was an undergrad and had seen him speak on campus. The former CEO of Procter & Gamble, Pepper was committed to human rights and making sure the story of the Underground Railroad was preserved in a museum devoted to the subject he was founding in Cincinnati. Pepper was known for his leadership and the innovations in marketing he had brought to Procter & Gamble. Even now, after stepping down, he continued to be a powerful influence on P&G's board and on the boards of several other companies. Knowing he had attended Yale, I knew he'd have a bio listed on the Yale University website. So I tapped into my alumni network for more information. There, I found a treasure trove of old college affiliations and interests. It turned out we had both been in Berklee College at Yale. That meant he must have known Robin Winks, a warmly admired and much respected professor for whom I had worked while in college. When I brought up our many common experiences, we hit it off. By the end of our conversation, John was giving me insightful advice about, and contacts for, my young company, Yaya at the time. He invited me to keep in touch in the coming years. I hoped our paths would cross many more times over the years, and they certainly have. When Professor Winks, Robin, passed away just a week later, we shared our memories of him. A few months later, I met a successful businessman from Cincinnati who was bragging about the museum enshrining the Underground Railroad, and I made a point of putting him in touch with John Pepper for fundraising. I've probably introduced two or three potential donors to John in the last year. I had no affiliations or organizations in common with the other CEO I wanted to meet. Luckily, a random Google search revealed that she had run the New York City Marathon the previous year. I know firsthand how much commitment and sacrifice it takes to train day in and day out to run and complete a marathon. I had tried and failed. I had begun to train for a marathon one year, but my knees started to act up, to my disappointment. By the way, I'm always looking for good advice on how I might someday be able to run a marathon. When I ran into the CEO, I said, "You know, I don't know how you do it. I like to think I'm in great shape, but the training for a marathon killed me. I had to stop." Of course, she was surprised. "How the heck did you know I ran a marathon?" she happily quipped. Keep in mind, this was before everyone was posting their training logs, race plans, and finish line photos all over the internet. I never shy away from mentioning the research I've done. I've always made a special effort to inquire about the people I'd like to meet. Inevitably, people are flattered. Wouldn't you be? Instantly, the other person knows that rather than suffering through a strained half hour with a stranger, they're able to connect with someone with whom they share an interest, someone who has gone out of his way to get to know them better. As it happened, the day before I had gone through Barry's Boot Camp, a tough-as-nails but totally exhilarating exercise regimen in West Hollywood, not far from the conference. I said, "If you want an amazing and different workout sometime, you should consider boot camp." In return, I received some welcome advice for extending my running regimen. Later, she tried boot camp with me and loved it. To this day, each time she and I meet, we talk about Barry's Boot Camp, and I give her my progress report on my goal of running a marathon. And what I have found with those I've converted to my boot camp workout is that when they visit L.A., they might not have time to take a meeting or lunch with others, but they often do make one non-business detour, and we have one hardcore workout together. Once again, your goal in such a setting is to transform what could be a forgettable encounter into a blossoming friendship. There are shortcuts in my system, but this isn't one of them. I wouldn't have been able to reach out to these individuals and truly connect without doing my homework. Chapter 8. Take Names. Once you've taken the time to figure out what your mission is and where you want to get to, the next step is to identify the people who can help you get there. The successful organization and management of the information that makes connecting flourish is vital. Tracking the people you know, the people you want to know, and doing all the homework that will help you develop intimate relationships with others can cause one heck of an information overload. How do you manage it? The real challenge isn't tracking everyone. Pretty much everything we do is tracked, even if we don't want the information. Someone out there sure does. Clay Shirky summed it up in 2008, and he's still right. The problem isn't information overload, it's filter failure. Our challenge these days is to figure out, in the mass of contacts we've collected, which ones matter. The people who build social platforms know this and are getting better at helping you filter out the noise. But their algorithms will never be as smart as you are about what really matters to you. The truth is, you don't really need technology to start getting a grip. What you need is focus and intention. Ink and paper are a perfectly suitable way to keep track of the top priorities in your expanding social life. I'm a list-taking madman, and you should become one too. My experience at Yaya is a good example of how lists help people achieve their goals. On my last day at Starwood, I made more than 40 phone calls. One of them was to Sandy Kleiman.